And now,
the definition. Definition.
Earlier today, one thing we talked about was civic engagement, and a line you used in the State of the Union address of don't give in to the cynicism of the day.
Right.
Poll released by Reuters yesterday showed that nearly half of Americans feel that the elections are rigged in some way.
Yeah.
Is there any goal or plan for the administration to help revitalize the faith in democracy that is seeming to be lacking?
Well, you know what? This is something that I've tried to do ever since I got into public office. As you know, I came into this work as a community organizer and strongly believe that our democracy only works when people participate. There are a lot of forces that feed cynicism. And there's no dispute that our democracy is not working as well as it should. I can tell you some of the reasons for that. One of it is that we have set up a system for electing state legislatures and members of Congress that involve the drawing of district lines that are gerrymandered. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the phrase, it basically means that those who are already in power draw the maps in such a way where they can be assured that these are either going to be Democratic seats or Republican seats. And what that's done is it's made very few seats competitive. So, for example, in the last election in 2012, Democrats actually cast substantially more votes in congressional elections, but ended up with substantially fewer seats. And the reason for that is in 2010, when the census was done and redistricting of congressional and House legislative seats were drawn, Republican governors and Republican majorities were responsible for drawing most of the seats. I want to be clear, Democrats aren't blameless on this either. But California, for example, has gone to a process of nonpartisan districting. The advantage there is not only do you make more seats competitive, but it also means that politicians have to compete for everybody's votes because they're not in safe seats. They're not in a safely Republican district or Democratic district. And what that does is it means they've got to not just appeal to the extremes of their party. Part of the reason we've seen polarization and gridlock here in Washington is because there's been this great sorting, and Democrats have moved much further, have moved left. Republicans have just gone way to the right. And it's harder then to compromise because members of Congress, and this same thing is true in state legislatures, are always looking over their shoulders, seeing if somebody in their own party might challenge them. And then the system doesn't work. So that's a big chunk of why people are cynical, because they feel like their votes don't count. And if you draw districts that are ironclad one party or another, then they're not entirely wrong. Another reason that people are cynical is money in politics. The Supreme Court issued a ruling, Citizens United, that allowed super PACs and very wealthy individuals to just finance all these ads that you guys see on TV all the time. Half the time, nobody knows who's funding them. And that makes you cynical, partly because most of this money is spent on negative ads. And so you're just hearing constantly how horrible everybody is. That'll make you feel pretty bad about the political process. And I'm a strong believer in finding ways in which we can make the financing of campaigns more democratic. Now, we've seen some interesting work being done for, you've got to give Bernie Sanders, for example, credit, building off some of the work that I did. I, in turn, built off the work that Howard Dean did for smaller donations, grassroots donors, be able in small contributions to allow candidates to be competitive. But I think that we don't want to leave that to chance. And that's much harder to do for members of Congress who are lower profile, so they don't get the sort of viral presence that allows them to raise that kind of money to compete. So we're going to have to solve money in politics. You as journalists are going to have a role to play in reducing cynicism. It is very hard to get good stories placed. You know, people will assign you stories about what's not working. It's very hard for you to write a story about, wow, this thing really works good. And just to take the federal government as an example, every day I've got 2 million people who work for the federal government, whether in our military, our law enforcement, our environmental protection, helping veterans, etc., and they are doing great work. And you rely on it in all kinds of ways, including when you check the weather, because you can thank the National Weather Service for putting satellites up so your smartphones tell you whether to bring an umbrella or not. But we just take that for granted. And if out of those 2 million employees, one person screws up somewhere, which every day you can count on somebody out of 2 million people probably doing something they shouldn't be doing, that's what's going to get reported on. Now, that helps keep government on its toes and accountable, but one of the things we have to think about is how do we tell a story about the things we do together that actually work so that people don't feel so cynical overall. But look, here's the bottom line, is that let's take the political process. As cynical as everybody is, and everybody's always trying to come up with these radical new plans to try to fix our democracy, and we need to do this and we need to do that, the truth is that part of the reason why our government doesn't work as well is because in a good presidential year, slightly more than half the people vote who are eligible, and the other half don't. And during an off-year election, when the president's not at the top of the ticket and people aren't getting as much attention, 40% of the people vote. Now, this system doesn't work if people opt out. And the easiest cure, the simplest cure for what ails our democracy is everybody voting. Now, it's true that there's some states that purposely make it hard for people to vote. We're the only major democracy in the world that actively makes it hard for people to vote. And so you should be, particularly as in your student newspapers, as you go back to your home states, you should be asking, why is it that we have laws that are purposely making it harder for people to vote, purposely making it harder for young people to vote? And there's a political agenda there. The people in power don't want things to change. They want cynicism. Because obviously the existing system, as frustrating as it is for everybody else, works for them. Well, if you want to upend that, we got to vote. But even in those states that purposely make it harder to vote, the truth of the matter is on your college campuses, half the folks, maybe two-thirds of the folks, who don't vote because they're just not paying attention. They don't consider it important. And they're not willing to take the 15 minutes or half hour that it takes to make sure that you're registered and make sure you actually vote. Well, if you care about climate change, you care about college costs, you care about career opportunities, you care about war and peace and refugees, you can't just complain. You got to vote. And what's interesting is young people, as a voting bloc, are the least likely to vote. But when you do vote, have the biggest impact on elections. During a presidential year, young people account for like 19% of the total vote. During an off-year election, when folks aren't paying as much attention, they account for 12%. And that means that the kinds of candidates that get elected and the priorities that they reflect are entirely different, just based on whether or not you guys are going to the polls. So don't let people tell you that what you do doesn't matter. It does. Don't give away your power. That should be the main message that you deliver all the time. And it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's you're a Republican, Democrat, Independent, whether you're conservative on some issues, liberal on others. If you participate and you take the time to be informed about the issues and you actually turn out and your peers turn out, you change the country. You do. It may not always happen as fast as you'd like, but you'll change it. So I'll keep on talking about this even after I leave the presidency. You got me started. I went on a rant, didn't I? All right. So I'm counting on you guys. Don't let me down. All right? Don't let the country down. You guys are going to be delivering the message to your peer group this is the greatest country on earth, but only because we have great citizens who are willing to invest their time and energy and effort to become informed on the issues, to argue about it in a respectful way, and to try to collectively solve the many challenges that we face. The good news is that there are no challenges, as JFK said, that man creates that man can't solve. I would add women to that. All right? Good luck, guys. Bye-bye.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother, Brian Marquis. Welcome to this Clash War Battlefield podcast episode. I have been looking through some old Obama archives, and you just heard a very long answer that he gave to a very important question. The title of the video that I pulled this from is Student Asks Obama About Cynicism and Gets a 10-Minute Rant That Nails It. Rant is a bad choice of words because he gave a professor, I can't even say that word, it's too late in the evening to say that word. I can't say that word. Anyway, one of those words. He gave a professor type of an answer. And yes, he nailed it. He absolutely nailed it. It inspired me to do this wonderful episode for you all. I think when it comes to voting, ladies and gentlemen, we have to look at it as multidimensional, and we have to look at it as more than just one act, which is what, truthfully, the wealthy have pushed us into seeing it as one act, a single act that we carry out every 4 years, mostly, 2 years if you're older, but 4 years if you're basically under the age of 40. They want us to see it that way. They want us to not see the importance that is inherent in voting every 2 years. They don't want us They don't want us understanding how, if we voted, particularly people under the age of 30, people under the age of 40, and more people under the age of 50, and yeah, I think 50 is the is about the cutoff line, even though I guess it drops dramatically in the 40s. But they don't want us to realize that if we were to just vote for three straight cycles of 2 years, we could remake the composition of the federal government. And if we were organized, I'm going to be talking a lot about organization today, we can remake it in one or two. That's their fear, is that we'll realize that voting requires an organizational principle that just has not quite been there when it comes to people who want a more commonwealth-oriented society, who believe that progressivism and conservatism are two sides of the same coin, that you can't have one without the other. I mean, that's really natural, guys. Seriously. See, in the 60s, and this is actually why that generation votes in significantly higher numbers than every generation after it. And this is something that they have completely hidden from you. In the 60s, voting was considered something you did of great importance. That is true. Voting was considered something you did of great importance. But protesting was something greater that you did of importance. Holding the feet to the fire of those who you placed in office was incredibly important. Yes, statistically, the number of people protesting was still a minority. At no time, if, you know, I've read, did you have more than like 25 or 30% of the population really engaged in activist work. But see, that those were the visible people. When you have numbers of people who are out on the street where you're, you know, when you're looking at 20%, 15%, I'd say between 15 and 20%, that's really a huge tipping point, because what that says is that the force that is pushing those people onto the street exists in every community. And it is so widespread that for every one person that's out there voting or out there protesting, you have two or three or four who may be a little bit too busy to protest, but they're in solidarity with them. They believe what they're doing is okay. Even if they may not agree with them, they still agree with the principle that they should do it. I don't want to give the interpretation that everything in the 60s was completely supported by everybody, because it wasn't. But believing that protesting is an important part of civic engagement, and not only just an important part, but a requirement, a necessity to fulfill your responsibility to the civic process, is or was at the heart of the 60s. After the 70s, and the reason why I say after the 70s is because this started waning purposely in the 70s. After the 70s, this feeling was roundly attacked. And not only attacked, but it was deliberately called, it was, and by the way, that's C-U-L-L-E-D, it was deliberately called, it was deliberately dismantled by wealthy folks who saw that spirit which had taken root in the 60s, the spirit which Dr. King likened to the original revolutionary spirit. Only if he was alive to read Gerald Horn's great book, Counter-Revolution of 1776, he might change his mind. But he likened it to the revolutionary spirit of 1776. The wealthy wanted to get rid of that. And they systematically, in the 70s, laid out a plan, that's the Powell memo, to get rid of it. And then they started laying down the foundation. And I choose that word deliberately, because they literally started putting together these right-wing foundations, all with their eye on dissipating, dismantling, and tearing apart the spirit which fed the 1960s. But that spirit was necessary. Oh, that spirit was necessary. Because when you feel, when you know, in fact, that your civic duty is not just voting, but it is putting your body on the line to protest, not in pro-democracy zones like they've created since 9/11, but in real life protests that threaten to shut down streets and highways and what have you to prove points of importance. It empowers you in a way that voting cannot. Voting becomes the extension of that activity. Voting becomes the extension of that activity because you become you see yourself as the moving force behind the civic discussion and the society. That's how you start to see yourself. And so because that was ingrained in that generation, in the baby boomer generation during the 60s and the 70s, these people are still civically engaged at all levels. It had to do with the activist concept back then. Everybody throws around the idea of activists, and they don't ever actually think about it. The chief role of an activist isn't to get you to care about something. Caring about something really, you know, that's easy. You can care about anything. You know how I know? Because people care about stuff all the time. There's stuff that you care about that you've never lifted a finger to do anything about. You may care about, you know, the oceans. Well, caring doesn't clean the oceans. You may care about forests. Caring doesn't stop people from, you know, massive logging and burning down parts of various forests. Just doesn't happen. No, an activist's job isn't even to bring awareness. Awareness is, it plays its role. I'm glad that you know that stuff is happening. But mostly, you know, an activist's job isn't about awareness. In a really good functioning democracy, you know, we have journalists to bring you awareness. An activist may at some time point to information, this happened back in the Vietnam War, that journalists uncovered and say, this is why we're fighting. But outside of that act of bringing awareness, that's not what an activist is there for. No. On a spiritual level, and I know progressives don't like to talk about this stuff. One of the reasons why I'm going to miss Michael Brooks, because he actually talked about the spiritual and the political. On a spiritual level, an activist's job is focused around bringing together the components internally that are necessary to trigger that humanitarian instinct which gives you superhuman strength enough to confront the powers that be. That is what an activist's job is. Now, you might say, well, how do you go about doing that? Well, in order to do that, you have to have an idea of what it means to have an humanitarian instinct. You have to understand what humanitarianism is, which is something that isn't really taught a lot in colleges much anymore. You have to be not just objective and critical. You have to have a strong liberal education foundation, which I'm just now starting to learn about, in order to affix higher ideals to the society and to say we aren't living up to these ideals. We used to call that section of learning in liberal education or in the liberal education system, we used to call it the humanities, which is rarely ever taught. People typically don't go into the humanities anymore. And trust me, I'm not acting like I'm some great scholar on the humanities or anything like that. No. But what I'm saying is, people wonder why was Dr. King and various other great civil rights leaders and Vietnam protesters, why were they so great? What gave them the intellectual fortitude to make the type of arguments that they were making, to see the world in the way that they were seeing it, and to construct the philosophy and the theories and the concepts which they used to not only explain their arguments, but to build a better vision? And how are these people able to do this at 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23? It is because they had this liberal education with the humanities and a civic concept which was higher than we have been taught recently. And by the way, Ronald Reagan literally, in the mid-80s, if I remember correctly, was out of the mid-80s or, you know, the last 2 years of his presidency, he let this out of the bag. He said that his goal in restructuring education was to get rid of the liberal education which had made the 60s possible. He said this. He knew what he was doing. The Heritage Foundation, who helped to give him the plans to do this, knew what they were doing. The Koch Network, which helped to fund plans to help him, they knew what they were doing. This was all part of what they wanted. They wanted a generation that was checked out of politics, who saw their only avenue into politics as voting. And guess what? That's where we are. That's where we are. They looked at the organizational structures, the radical organizational structures. And look, I can't just blame those people, because there were elements within the intelligence agencies, within the FBI, who wanted to rip apart the same fabric, the same spirit. They saw it as unnecessary in this country and not worthy of protecting. So they wanted to shred it. They saw the radical organizations that came out of the 60s as threats to the stability of the society. Not, by the way, the corporations, not the wealthy, who literally, you know, this is in the 70s, over 40 years earlier, had literally, through their greed and incompetence, had almost brought the country down.
I mean, they didn't see that as a potential problem or likely problem. They saw democracy in action as a problem. And so the organizations which came out of the 60s, just like the organizations that came out of the 40s, they were devastated. They were attacked. And this idea of radicalism, which was key and is always key in any great democracy, you need radicalism. This idea of radicalism in the 1940s, it was criminalized. Or excuse me, in the 1950s, it was criminalized. That was your McCarthy hearings. In the 1980s, they were smarter. Yes, they criminalized the ideas. They made fun of the ideas. But instead of doing that en masse, which would have aroused people's suspicions, they minimized radicalism. They minimized radicalism so very much that we, I think it was either the middle or the late part of the 80s, this country started using radical as a catchphrase to mean cool or awesome. They literally minimized it. And then, in the 1990s, they recriminalized it. But this time, they did it from the standpoint of basically naming it a mental disorder. Something that is catching. You don't want to catch that. That isn't good for you. Stay away from it. And they did that over and over and over, particularly through the mid-90s, from the mid-90s through, the Bush administration. Radical Islam. They always wanted to throw that in there. Radical Islam, radical Islam, radical Islam. That radical was the important part, to make you think that there was something wrong with it. Even in the health field, they view free radicals as bad. When in fact, the concept of radical the concept of radical is connected to revolution, or as Earth, Wind, and Fire say it, it's evolution, really. That's what revolution is. It has to do with revelating, pushing forward, and evolving. Radicalism is the structures necessary for that, and harnessing the power which is inert. In some people it's inert, but it is inherent in the person. It's there already. Sometimes it's inert. Sometimes it's being misused. But radicalism draws on that energy that is already there and sparks it with knowledge and forethought and vision and clarity, and pushes the person forward with esteemed confidence to make that a reality, to make the revolution true. This is what was discovered in the 1960s. It's powerful because it destroys while it creates. It creates while it destroys. And because radicalism by itself is unifying, it attracts others. Just like healthy cells, they attract others. It also builds and strengthens community. Because ultimately, radicalism, and I, you know, for years I've looked at the word, and it's the power that is innate in radicalism isn't really communicated well in the Western civilization definition that it's afforded. But radicalism, you know, when you really get down to it, it is that it is the actualization of connectiveness towards a maturing point. If you know that is somewhat how I view it, and it's that maturing point that brings about the evolution, the revolution. I mentioned to you before that progressivism and conservatism are, you know, one side of the same coin. You can't really have one without the other. Well, if we look at how this works, because I've said to you that it's natural, that you can't really have conservatism and without progressivism, progressivism without conservatism. If we look at this principle in action, we can also see radicalism in its truest state and in its natural state. Let's take a young baby. Everyone knows what a baby looks like. Young human baby, by the way. Everybody's at least seen one, so you know what they look like. Have you ever held a newborn? Or close to a newborn? You know, let's say within a month old. Well, I want you to think about holding that newborn. When you're holding that newborn, and you're looking at the parents, have you ever thought to yourself, man, this newborn is going to make a fine horse when they're 10 years old? Don't laugh, even though it is funny. Of course you haven't. Of course you haven't. You've never thought that, because you don't expect a human baby to turn into a horse by the time they're 10 or ever, really. Why? Because they're human. At the simplest level, the idea of a baby turning into a child, turning into a preteen today, and then a teen, and then an adult, and then, you know, an older adult, that is the conservative principle at work. Conservatism maintains the structure that the original was. Or should I say, conservatism maintains the form which the original prototype or the original type had within itself, but allows for still there to be growth. So, maintains that form. That's what conservatism does. And some would just say, well, maybe they also just maintain the genetic strength of the child, which also works for me, too. That game from somebody who I told this to, by the way. But progressivism says is, you don't expect that baby to remain a baby for 5 years. In 5 years, that baby will be a young child. That's progressivism. So conservatism maintains the structure. The child will be born with one heart, hopefully a good heart, so that heart's going to remain theirs throughout life, most likely. They'll be born with two kidneys. God forbid anything negative happens, those two kidneys will remain their kidneys for life. Two lungs, theirs for life. The structure remains the same, but it grows. The structure remains the same. That's conservatism. But it grows. That's progressivism. Where radicalism comes in is when there are drastic changes in the child's life. So one could argue, and I think it's a right argument, when a child moved from the toddler phase to the child phase, which I think is 4 or 5 years old, there is a sharp difference in that child. Any parent knows this. That's a revolutionary moment. When that child moves into the preteen phase, every parent knows that's significantly different. That's a revolutionary moment. That's a radical change. When they go from preteen to teen, I mean, back in my day, not too long ago, but long enough, puberty was the major marker after childhood, which I think should still be the marker, but whatever. The child goes through a lot of changes for puberty. And then the next step in puberty was typically them becoming a teenager, which sometimes coincided. And then after that is kind of the cooling of the waters, which is around 18 to 21. Now, biologically, there is another major change, I think, in the mid-20s when the brain kind of settles down. Then there's another major biological brain change in the 30s. But physically, the major external changes, typically between 18 and 21, and then usually in the late 30s, the mid to late 30s, metabolism starts to trail off, and age starts to be more readily apparent on the face and in the body. And then in the early 50s, sometimes the mid 50s, you start really getting those physical changes that suggest older age. And then obviously throughout the 60s into the early 70s, the same thing happens. These are revolutionary changes though, and that's radicalism. There are points in life when you go through radical change. And it does nobody good if you resist those changes. It really could cripple you if you resist those changes. In the 60s, such a radical change was evident. It was in the air. It was everywhere. And it changed the psychological makeup of that generation. That is why they approach public life so differently. We, in this generation, we need to really change the way that we see these things and change the way that we engage in civic life. This I think may be the most powerful gift given to this country by COVID-19 is the resurrection of this energy. Now, organically, it started to rise back in 2011 with Occupy Wall Street. But it was quickly tamed. But it never went away. And we're seeing that. Now, you might be wondering, okay, why did you really play the Obama bit? Why would you play that at the beginning of this when you're going to be talking about all of these other things? It is because I found myself going through some old Obama videos. And two, I played it because I wanted to really remind you, Obama got it. But the problem wasn't Obama. The problem was everything else. You couldn't push Obama to the left because the Democratic establishment didn't want him going to the left. You couldn't push him to the left because the Republicans weren't going to go to the left. And the few who tried were beaten up badly by wealthy people. Research the Red Map Project. Also, I wanted you all to hear and remember just how competent he was. Because ultimately, you know, truthfully, I think Trump has kind of scrambled our brain, and many people remember Obama as being far worse than he was. Also, as we're moving into this very tumultuous, turmoil-laden period of time, I wanted to remind you, don't get stuck in cynicism. Don't get stuck in cynicism. We have the opportunity to remake this country, and indeed, we have the opportunity to remake this world. But in order to do it, we're going to have to resurrect who we are. We are. That's just a fact. We're going to have to resurrect who we are. The question is, who are we? Who are we? Well, I'm going to tell you who we are not. We are not a bunch of quitters. A couple of weeks ago, a couple months ago now, I released a 5-part podcast series on race. And in it, in the first part of that 5-part series, which was, by the way, the same episode, I'm a big believer in the idea that an episode tells a story or completes a thought. So, you know, I hate this idea on TV where they tell a story over the course of 2 or 3 episodes, and they literally say they are 2 or 3 episodes, when in fact, no, they're 2 or 3 parts of an episode. But nonetheless, I digress. That's just me. I told a story, a sympathetic story, about black people and how slavery and being hunted by white vigilantes and how that could leave marks on the soul and how you don't forget certain traumatic events. And, you know, I'm not going to tell a similar story now, but I will tell you this. That I believe we are entering a period of time where the spirit of the 60s, the spirit of the 30s, is about to come back. If you really look at it, it's kind of interesting because you got the 30s, you got the 60s, and then the 90s, in the beginning of the 90s, there was a little bit of ruffling, but thanks to culture and how it was kind of hijacked in the end of the 80s, that fizzled out pretty quickly. And now here we are in the 2020s. And it appears that all of that energy that was stopped in the 1990s is going to hit the ground hard this decade. Yes, to some people, that may sound absolutely absurd. But trust me, there are many, many people on the right who know what I'm talking about and believe it. Don't forget, Steve Bannon has been writing about a potential civil war occurring in the middle of this decade. Why? Well, ladies and gentlemen, very quickly, for those of you interested in astrology, you could find your answer there. Steve Bannon doesn't talk about astrology, but it's pretty clear that he has studied it. Even if it's just on the margins, or else how, seriously, how else would he know, I mean, there is a clear pattern, that every so many years, there seems to be this divot in time where the country goes through some very rapid changes, and some very powerful reorganizations. And he's been preparing for this since the 1980s. I've been waiting for something to happen. In other words, we have a lot of homework to do. We got to catch up. With the blood and the ink of the headline. But and the sound of the crowd in my I'm going to leave it here. You might ask let you think about what I just said. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. I am your brother, Von Merdis. I'll see you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone, and there are lives in the balance. Thank you.